Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here for the next hour on KLBB Club 1220. Voice a little hoarse today. That Paul McCartney concert took a lot out of the old vocal cords last Saturday.
I haven't even heard about that yet. How was that?
That's the first half hour of the show today. We're talking about that.
Now we might
make a little comment on that. Tom Hsu working the board today. We got a great hour program today. We have a good friend of mine who is a video producer, Paul Augustin, will be in live studio today. Talk a little about his work with video production and a lot of work he's done with youth groups and kids over the years. I might be one of them. There's a lot of I could be one of those students that was benefited from his learnings. And I do want to talk about a couple of things, though, before we get started with the other part of the show. Paul McCartney, now, you were not there, correct?
I was not.
No, I was there, and it was a great show. I think he played 39 songs, actually. 3 hours of music. It was.
Did he play a lot of the songs from Wings as well?
There was some Wings. There were some.
Those songs were pretty long. Those were like 4 minute songs.
There were some 4 minute Wings songs. You know, I've seen Paul McCartney 3 times, and this was probably the best seats I had ever had. And it's worth seeing if you ever hum and haw about the price of tickets. Don't, because it's worth the price of it. And once you're down there singing along, you don't care about how much you paid to see it. The only challenge I had, though, Tom, was, you know, every Saturday, Tom, our producer, does a dance off in the studio.
I can't help it. It's a catchy intro.
Flashback Twin Cities theme song plays. Second time at a Paul McCartney concert, I was told to be quiet by someone next to me.
Someone told you to be quiet?
Second time I've actually been told to be quiet at an outdoor concert.
What, were you belting out the songs?
I don't recall that. I recall everyone else having a great time singing along, but there was someone next to me, and I don't think they recognized me from the show. But it was someone next to me that said, you know, you're ruining the rest of us. Me and my companion, we looked at each other like, okay, all right. So we just kept on singing.
Interesting. I've been to – I don't go to a ton of concerts. I went to a Metallica one,
mm-hmm.
and everybody in the entire stadium was singing.
Right.
I couldn't even hear Metallica, but everyone was having a great time.
That was also the case with Paul McCartney. Unfortunately, we were next to someone who thought they were at the Minnesota Orchestra on Saturday night, which, by the way, I've also been to. And there's – if we had been at the orchestra, they would have every right to – complain about my
sure
singing oh blah dee oh blah da, but I thought we were having a good time, and according to the videos I took that night, we did have a good time.
It's so loud there, I can't understand how anybody would have any issue at all. It's like getting told to be quiet during the trailer of a movie.
Well, there's that too, but no, it was outdoor concert, beach balls being thrown around, people were singing with all different kinds of pitches and volumes and accents to Paul McCartney songs. No, great concert.
Very cool.
One of those generational things that I think that everyone will remember, Paul McCartney live at Target Field. He did say at the end of the show he'll see us next year, and hopefully it is in the form of a concert. And by the way, I love new Paul McCartney music, but I want him to come back to town and do some more work. So there's a couple of big anniversaries this week, and I want to talk about these briefly. Does the name Philip Petit ring a bell?
No. Can't say he does.
40 years ago, this is on August 7th, a 24-year-old Frenchman captivated the world when he walked across a steel-high wire suspended between New York City's Twin Towers.
Yeah.
Philip Petit, in an interview with The Telegraph to mark the anniversary of the 1974 stunt, called the performance the highlight of his life. He first got the idea when he read about the World Trade Center in a magazine at a dentist's office. The towers hadn't been finished yet, and Petit took 6.5 years to plan the walk, according to Telegraph. The walk was not sanctioned by the city. Petit referred to it as the artistic crime of the century. He prepared for the walk by practicing tightrope walking, studying the towers, and finding people who were willing to assist him in his quest. Petit got to the roof by posing as a French journalist, according to the Telegraph. He persuaded someone inside the towers to forge security passes for him. The day of the walk, Petit and some assistants hid in the towers and set up a cable before dawn, according to the AP. The 110-story buildings were more than a quarter mile high, and the two buildings were about 200 feet apart. Petit did not use a safety net or harness, according to the Daily Mail. Petit was arrested when he got off the wire, but his charges were eventually dropped before he agreed to perform for children in Central Park, according to the Telegraph.
Charges dropped for it being awesome?
For being awesome, and Philip agreed to perform for children in the park. Now, what he was performing, we don't know. Maybe he was walking on tight ropes. You see it at Lake Calhoun quite a bit. He's walking on, you know, people are walking on the tight rope. But it's pretty amazing. And there's going to be a movie about called The Walk, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, is slated for release in 2015. There's also a 2008 documentary, Man on Wire, about Petite's Walk, which won an Oscar. Not Bird on a Wire with Goldie Hawn, Man on Wire with would be the 2008 documentary. Also, another big anniversary. You guys may have discussed this during the week. August 8th, 1974. Who resigned?
I'm going to go with, I don't know.
Okay. This is great. We're teaching history here. 40 years ago, on August 8th, 1974, President Richard Nixon announced he would resign the presidency the following day, becoming the first American president to do so. So from USA Today has just a few quick facts, and we're not going to get political here on Flashback.
Oh, we never do that.
It does sometimes, but here's some numbers. Five people were arrested for breaking into the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate complex. 18 and a half minutes was a gap of time missing from a June 20, 1972 recording between Nixon and his chief of staff. Nixon assistant Rose Mary Woods claimed she accidentally erased that part. You know what happens when you accidentally erase
that specific section?
Day, that those 18 minutes.
We've all been there.
8-0 was the Supreme Court voted 8-0 on July 24th, 1974 to make the Nixon tapes public, or actually make them turn over the White House tapes. 24% was Nixon's approval rating at the time of his resignation, according to Gallup. His ratings had reached as high as 67% earlier in his administration.
That's pretty impressive, to be fair.
9:01 p.m., Nixon delivered a televised speech from the Oval Office announcing his resignation on August 8, 1974. President Nixon's final meal in the White House, one glass of milk, one scoop of cottage cheese, and one pineapple slice. with pineapple slices.
That's very specific.
33 years later, the length of time Deep Throat, the Washington Post secret source, remained unknown. In 2005, his family revealed his true identity, W. Mark Felt, the FBI's number two during Nixon's administration. 33 years, we did not know who Deep Throat was. And there you go.
And isn't that the giant conspiracy theory that boggled our minds for the latter half of the 20th century?
It you know, many good movies are made from that particular moment. And so tightrope walking and Nixon resigning 40 years ago, this day in history. Well, let's take a quick break. We come back. We'll have Paul Augustin talk a little bit about the journey of filmmaking over the past couple of decades, working with students and yours truly. We'll do that after this quick break here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here on KLBB Club 1220 with my very special guest, Paul Augustin of iDream TV. Paul?
Well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show today.
So, Paul, we've known each other for about, I think we decided, 22 years today. And when I first met Paul, I was a young aspiring filmmaker myself. And as you can see, that has turned out to be quite fruitful for me. Well, it's, a few projects here and there. But, we were just talking before the show just on what kind of equipment we were using to make video and film. And the physical strength it took to lift these cameras up in and out on these field locations. And you come, not to date you, but you come from the film world too, where you actually were developing film before you had to process a lot of film before you could actually make that picture happen. You couldn't just snap it on a phone and show it to us.
Well, I went to a film school called Film in the Cities in St. Paul, and it was actually a program for youth. We studied sound. We studied film production. Mm-hmm. I eventually got a job there, actually, mm-hmm. and actually was in charge of the animation department and built a couple studios. And so I had a very similar setup to what we have here today. But I did have really great mentors. I met some really fantastic people, Paco Grande, Tom DiBiase, Molly Davies. These are all people that really influenced me in alternative filmmaking, experimental films, and film for really for art's sake. So mm-hmm. And of course you have to look at the kind of movies we were watching, and we had Smokey and the Bandit. So Hollywood was not really a way for us to. I mean, we didn't really respect that kind of filmmaking, and we also had a really strong feeling about trying to be deconstructionists. I mean, we tried to tear a film apart and change it and manipulate it in different ways. And
it's breaking those barriers down. And I think that, a little bit of what I'm, and I've always said the same thing too, is it's selling out. You almost feel like movies like Smoking the Bandit, which, by the way, it was entertaining when I saw it 25, 30 years ago. But it's entertaining to watch. But you always feel like, are we smarter than that? Can we do something more than this? And is this really our best artistic work? And artistic work and commercial work don't always go hand in hand.
No, that's true, and I think that's one of the hard things that you have to face as an artist. Are you going to, you know, stay true to your own ideas and, you know, stand for those kinds of things, or are you going to be commercially successful? Mm-hmm. And so as we were, you know, thinking about the kinds of movies and the kinds of reality shows that are being made today, it's truly amazing. I mean, I do think that Summer Academy kids have actually come back now to, you know, to make their movies. And
just to put the audience here, Summer Academy was a suburban, and I think Stillwater was part of this, it was a suburban classes for high potential youth that could, you know, kind of take those skills that they were not able to realize during the school year, and there was about 3 or 4 week course in the summer that you were part of, and you taught these courses. Making Movie Magic, I think, was the name of the course. But you've also you didn't stop there. You've also taught you know, a lot of urban kids too in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Also, you know, the art of filmmaking. That's really what I want to kind of talk about today. Is you've been working with children and students, you know, from day one, and you continue to do so even though you've, you know, obviously been financially able. You wouldn't have to do that. And what gives you the drive to do that still?
Well, I think we came by it quite honestly. We wanted to make movies, and we wanted to put those tools into young people's hands. I mean, that was the job, the task. And one of the groups that I started with was a place called Native American Youth Service, and I wrote a grant to get, at that time, SX-70 cameras were very popular. I wanted to always be a photographer, really. Mm-hmm. I went out to Cambridge. I went to Polaroid, and I sold them this program where we would take urban Native American kids down to the Southwest to do Polaroid photography, and basically to have our students teach the reservation kids.
What year was this?
This is about 1975.
Right.
And so it was actually the first project that I actually got to be a lead on, mm-hmm. and I took control of the thing. And we got a bus. We had a school bus. We took about 18 kids with us down there, and we had an exchange program. And a couple things came out of that. One was, through filmmaking, we could, like, have cultural identity, which was really amazing. And I had worked with the kids up in Minneapolis a bit, and I was always surprised at what they would film with their cameras. I mean, they tended to, if it was an animal or if it was alive, it was a squirrel, they really wanted to film that. A dog chained in the yard would be filmed. They were just kind of reflecting what they were living in, and it was a way for us to kind of cross cultures a bit. I think the photographs were not really spectacular, but they really captured a time and a moment, and it gave our kids a real
identity.
A purpose. I mean, they got to teach filmmaking with very cool tools, and they liked that.
Well, and let's look at this in context. In 1975, a Polaroid camera. This is a world where, you know, instant pictures. That's, you know, right now we're so used to having everything instant, and our attention spans are very short right now, and we expect immediacy. If I can't get online to get, you know, downloaded web video in 2 seconds, I'm beating my fists. You know, this is in the mid-70s. A Polaroid camera, that was a very innovative tool to actually see a picture right away. You didn't have to wait to go to the photo mat to go wait, you know, 2 days to get your photos back, and then half them were probably fuzzy and red.
It was a beautiful picture, and it was in color, and it was, in a way, it was, you know, a precursor to digital. It was very clean. There was no chemicals. You know, the old Polaroids, you peeled apart this thing, and there was all this acid and developer and all that. Polaroids were completely self-contained, and you could manipulate them after the fact. You could a picture could come up, and then you could scratch on the back and create all kinds of Photoshop-type techniques. I mean, alterations to the picture that made them really interesting. That really led me to working with state arts boards. I went around to do a lot of projects throughout the Midwest and the West, where I'd go in for 2 or 3 weeks and do small filmmaking projects. But they were really film. Mm-hmm. We used Super 8 film. we manipulated that film too. We learned that we could develop our own film, and so we would actually.
That sounds dangerous.
Well, it was actually it wasn't. I mean, you could you know, you had these again. You had chemicals in a dark room, and the kids really liked bringing. I mean, it was insane. I mean, we'd shoot a film, develop it in the afternoon, and watch it at night, and so we kind of had this return thing to it. I went on to be I was a director of photography. I had a movie in the Venice Film Festival in 1982. Came back to Minnesota.
What film was that?
It was a film called Beyond the Far Blue Mountains, and it was again, it was a kind of an experimental movie. Molly Davies was the director of it. We ended up showing that film around Europe and in the United States. At a lot of Lou Harrison did the music for it. A couple young people were in it. We came back to Minnesota, Edie and I did, my wife now, and we thought that we would just go back and make films again. But unfortunately,
my question is, you go to Venice to film festival, you come back to Minnesota in the '80s. Why is that? You could go to Hollywood. You could go to New York.
Well, we could have, but our homes were here, our families were here, and we had kind of run through. You actually, if you've been on the road for like 5-6 years, which I had been. You just want to come home at some point and start to build something. We didn't, you know, I wanted to drive my Jeep and have my dog, and, you know, those are the things that were important to me. But there was like no film work. People were all doing video. And so the way we came into the video business was after calling, you know, people that we had made films with, everybody said, "Do you make video?" And probably after the saying no to five people, the sixth person, we said, "Yeah, we make video." And he said, "We don't make video." And I said, "Yeah, we're going to be making video." And so we got a job, paid $600. It was for shooting one day. And we rented the best. I said, "Look, we'll just rent the best camera we can get." We got an Ikigami HL79, rented for $600 a day, which was exactly what we were getting paid for. And I said, "If we use this camera, we will never be we can always say that we filmed with this camera, that we would know this tool set." Mm-hmm. And it actually worked out very good for us because we rented the best camera in the world, learned how to use it, used it, and then could go around and say, "Hey, we can make videos."
Now, the dangerous thing in any kind of amateur or professional photography, though, is you're learning how to use a tool while your subject is moving, and then sometimes you have one shot at that. Now, I'm wondering now, were you learning with the manual as you went along how to shoot with this very, very expensive camera on the day of this project you've probably been paid for?
We spent the night before going through the manual.
Okay.
And we did bring on another person who was making a film in town at the same time, who had done some video work to help us with the camera. So we did not actually have to have the manual out. Although I can say that the manual is always very close by, even today. I was doing a shoot the other day where I actually had the I was using an Aja Key Pro and needed to know how to format the drives because I had crashed a drive. And so I actually pulled up the CD, pulled up the PDF, and learned how to do it right while I was shooting the thing. So, yeah, I think, you know, earn what you learn has been one of my successes. I mean,
our guest today, Paul Augustin, he is with iDream TV. I once shot a film video. And because I might not have had the manual that close to me, I thought I had had the colors corrected. It actually turned to be blue. Like the whole, I mean, it was not, you know, it was, everyone was blue. So I just said it was artistic. That was my purpose. I made it out of, I wanted to have the calming, cool effect of this outdoor.
Lies.
Oh, it was, in fact, it was an outdoor film about nature. And I literally spent many hours working on this project. And it was other people. And I was the director of photography. And this is why I'm doing the job I do now and not the job of that. But it all came out to be blue. And then, of course, on the fly, I had to make up like, well, see, the purpose of this is we're all – it's cool colors. It's monochromatic. We're, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, feeling soothing. It worked. I didn't fail.
You still had a filter. You had an 85B filter in the camera that would switch you from tungsten to daylight. And mm-hmm. So you just had it switched to the tungsten filter and wasn't corrected it right. So later, of course, with white balance, it's amazing. I mean, we really became very, very spoiled by what we could do electronically. Because mm-hmm. in film, you had to mess around with all of, you know, to get the right color was, you know, basically would take you, I mean, it was a major production to get the colors all right.
So you worked in film throughout the month, or actually in video throughout the 80s, which was innovative at the time because it was kind of that period in the early 80s when film was going away. I mean, even, you know, the TV stations in town were all going video. You know, the processing labs were fading away. It was actually, you know, video is the way to go. You went back again then, and we talked about before, Summer Academy, which is North Suburban Summer Academy. You went back into education again every year, and you did this for a long time. How did that job role, you know, come about?
Well, there was a real need for people to teach ideas. Cable companies really wanted to push their cable systems to communities. And so they were very smart and clever about this. They would go into a town and sell the town on what video could do. So you would go in, you'd have a van, for instance, and you had to set up a van. You would train the people from the community to do the city council meeting or to do something like, you know, a project in the schools or a board meeting or whatever, a picnic or something. You would have the community do it and thereby show that this having cable in their town was going to be a fantastic way for their community to be involved in
Comcast is so selfless.
Oh, they were. They are. Well, they were then too. They were the same thing. But you know, the idea was that cable companies would pay part of their money to a franchise fee, which would support this community programming.
Right.
So they. The next step of that was that they had this equipment, and they certainly had people that could teach how to use equipment. They did not have people that would do storytelling or teach ideas, and that's kind of where we got involved in it, where we could go into a town, spend 12 weeks in a community, make the programming for their channel, show what could really be done, and train a whole cadre of young people to embrace this media, right? And then hopefully after we left that they would continue on with it. And lots of times they did. The problem with cable access in a lot of ways was that it was run by basically petty bureaucrats. I have a healthy disdain for authority. We did end up in one town. It was Cedar Falls, Iowa, where we had not really edited any shows before. We hadn't used that technology. So this is back to the manual. What did we do? We sat in front of the machine, and the access guy's eyes narrowed and said, you know, we sort of said, well, how do you turn this on? And he said, I thought you said you edited before. And Edie just burst in. She goes, well, yeah, but we use CMX editing. I don't even know where she came up with this. Immediately, this guy who had only heard of CMX editing, which was a kind of computer-based, entry of time code.
Right, because computers in film and video, that was a very new thing, too.
It was coming in, right, though, and Grass Valley was doing a lot of stuff to have – well, actually, the guy David Bargan, who invented the idea of time code was actually invented for NASA because for the Apollo flights because they knew that the spacecraft was going to go around the dark side of the moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
They needed to have an accurate way to account for the time so that even if you went behind the moon, when you came out, you would still have the real time because you had this was very important for when you were going to, you know, power up your thrusters, when you were going to do all these events, right? So time code came out of the space program and then was adopted into video. So David Bargan went on to work for Grass Valley. We became Grass Valley disciples. We went out to Grass Valley to study with them, to learn editing. We thought originally that we were going to go to Grass Valley and we were going to ski all the time. We were avid skiers. We had made ski films for the United States Ski Association to do to push freestyle skiing into the Olympics. And we were successful in that. That was one of our first big campaigns and film successes. But we were going to go out to Grass Valley to ski. And the very first day, I thought I'd pick up the handouts and I'd just take off, right? And of course, they had a little brew pub there, and there was all kinds of wonderful reasons to be in Grass Valley. But the class was so freaking interesting. I mean, we were like kids again, and we just went, "This is amazing. This is going to be, you know, editing had become, was revolutionized by this technology."
Well, the idea, I think, to be able to get your ideas out there, and you have in your mind, we have these concepts. Okay, we're in bed, we're thinking of all these great ideas, and some of my best ideas are thought in bed, by the way, Tom. We have these great ideas, and then how do I make you see my ideas? And one way is through writing. One way, and for me, it's always been through visual. Okay, how do I illustrate what it is? And I, with the film technology in the last 30 years, and every era when the video toaster came out, we thought this. And by the way, this is just a video editing system with a computer. We thought, oh, you know, wow, we're gonna be able to actually put our video on computers. manipulate how we want it, do it, add effects, and we're going to make these Hollywood movies from our desktops. And now, I mean, I look at things that kids are putting on YouTube, and I say kids, anyone younger than me, putting on YouTube, and they are – the production values are – they're – you know, in the cable access era, it was very bad audio, bad fuzzy picture. And now, just through accidental through technology, the production values are there, and now these storylines actually are, there's some pretty innovative, imaginative stories that are happening too, just in our phones now. So it's amazing how we just keep progressing. One thing I want to say about cable access, it did create a great library from coast to coast of great programming, because anyone could come down to cable access and decide they're going to be a talk show host. Now, granted, we have one right here who came and decided to be a talk show host, but you watch Channel 3 or whatever it was, Channel 6, and every topic from how to make baskets underwater to the whatever political affiliation that you had, which might be very unpopular, might have a show. It still amazes me the kind of programming the cable access has, and it's 40 years of amateur and hilarity filmmaking, always in the guise of being serious.
There were a few brilliant moments in cable access, and you have to also look at the kind of kids that came to television. They were often kids that were the brightest kids in the school. They had wonderful ideas. They needed to get those ideas out in some way, and so where a generation before them might want to be in a garage band, or that was their hopes to be. I heard that Metallica was actually sung along to. That's pretty interesting. I didn't know you could sing along to Metallica. I knew you could ski to it, but
sure.
But so you had this whole group of kids that had very important ideas inside. They had to get them out some way, and that's where it kind of came into that second wave of kids who were in they were in suburban schools. They were really being their ideas were being boxed in. They were really being censored in so many ways, and they had this opportunity to make television, and we tried to really allow them to express themselves and in the most positive ways that we could. We wanted them to go outside of the talk show idea. I mean, certainly talk shows, that was the first time that television had been democratized. I mean, anybody, you could be a tow truck driver and you could have your own talk show, right? And what better way to get information from people? And that's, for me, this is interesting to be on this side of it, because I've always felt like the best part about my job is talking to and learning from other people. So, I mean, I have a great curiosity for what's going on with other people, cultures, ideas, all of those things,
Well, in the school year is not always the best place when you're in a school classroom of 30 people and you're in an English class. And, I always resented, by the way, in TV movies that the guy who was into film was always the outcast of the group. But he was always the either the geeky, the nerdy, which I wore those badges proudly. That he was the outcast, and he he was a different one. And you take these kids and put them into a group where they're all everyone is at that same level or that same interest, and then there's no outcast, and then you get this burst in creativity, and sometimes it can create some big waves. Some products might even be frightening to some people, but that was always the best part about what you did in Summer Academy with kids was gave an opportunity, like, you want to make films? Okay, here's cameras, and I'll even show you how to do them. I mean, not limiting it. Yeah, sometimes you have to limit it occasionally. But really fostering those ideas.
We found that one thing, bringing all those kids together where they were and believing in them where they were right then, and having them also learn to respect each other and care for each other's ideas, that was the most important part of what we were doing. We wanted you guys to express yourselves, and we wanted you to, explore the issues that were important to you. And you have to realize, in those days, I mean, so many things were right under the surface in the culture, but nobody would talk about it, but kids would. And I think that was the most enlightening part of it, was that, one, we got you guys to really be tolerant of each other, to care for each other, and to respect the ideas that you were trying to give. And we had one problem, which is always the problem of probably being an educator or a teacher, is that you are kind of you couldn't really do your program unless you were responsible to the genies in the world, who was always trying to put like this – they wanted it to be legitimate. And it also had to do with the parents. I mean, there were no parents that wanted to see their kids expressing themselves in a tutu. I mean, that was one of the one things that we just – I remember this guy being like – the guy was like a superintendent. The parent was like the superintendent of the school.
I recall the story.
A young
man was trying to express himself in a film, and he thought the best way to do that would be in a tutu. And his father, of course, was the superintendent of schools. You know, it just, you know, this is back in the 90s. It created some ruffle. I mean, Tom, now when you express yourselves in your feather boa, have you had the same kind of problem?
Oh, not often.
Okay.
Jesse legitimized it. So
yeah, right. See,
I mean,
you're in a different age, though, now. You can be, you know, now it's perfectly fine. I think back in the day it was, and also it's a kid doing it. You know, that was the other thing, too. But you guys were very, very smart. I mean, I would say that you were some of the smartest kids basically you were the top kids in the school. Would come to this program, and it became a cult. I mean, it got out of control. It began, I lost control of it at some point where I just really was just now a mediator and kind of going between
you came into it being
staff
the cool
and
teacher,
you
now
guys.
You're a mediator. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you had to because I mean, we were constantly under threat, and I was actually, and it wasn't just from the other school people. I mean, it was even from the access people would make, you know, they had not seen this kind of energy and enthusiasm that you guys brought to it.
There's a bit of frightening thing when you see it. I take it back. Now, don't laugh at me. When you see the Bad News Bears, okay, and you watch these kids speak in a very adult language, and they're very, you know, they're cursing and they're talking like adults do. There's a bit of unsettlingness to adults to think the kids are supposed to be cute. They're supposed to be, you know, you could go back to this, you know, 50s model of what the kids are. They're smiling. They have nice hair. And then to see kids doing very sophisticated adult things, which I think that they probably don't express to their parents at dinner, but they do it when they have a camera between them or, you know, writing or anything. I think that the parents sometimes saw things that kids are writing or doing, you know, there will be some unsettledness. And I think that's part of it is, you know, part of it is seeing, oh, this is what my children think. Now I'm scared. Do I sleep at night with one eye open?
I think it was very healthy for the kids to get it out. And it probably – I think we also had parents that were – that had a bigger world view, and I'm just thinking of a lot of the parents from that main group. I mean, what came out of that group was an entire generation of kids that wanted to make television, all went into becoming – I mean, I'm most proud of this because you guys all went into continuing your lives somehow in television and media. You all found different directions to go, whether you were making Hollywood movies or restoring television films like you're doing now.
I'm just restoring people's garbage I find in the dumpster, actually. But, I take that as a
compliment. But it kind of – you know, maybe Summer Academy was like garbage dumping. I don't know. What they call that?
Dumpster diving.
Yeah, sure. Maybe that's what it really was. We kind of went into the big dumpster and we'd come out with a live show after 3 weeks, which was to justify our existence. And then we'd kind of show off this media thing in a big way on a night when the parents would come by and you guys were operating a truck. And it was the same old thing that's been going on in cable for 10 or 15 years. But in fact, it seemed all new and fresh because you guys brought new energy to it. And you know, you had control. You got to switch. You know, how many kids – I mean, we gave up the stuff. We said, do it. So you did your own switching. You did your own shooting. You had control of your own editing. And there was power through the tools.
And right? Thanks to the YouTube, these products might be floating around somewhere. Our guest today, Paul Augustin with iDream TV. It's iDreamTV.
Well, it's iDream.tv. It's a website and it is a company. Yeah, it was – and 10 years ago when we switched over – we had location images for a long time. We switched it over. And we wanted to be on that wave. So,
but you're a survivor of the business, and what I mean by that is, you know, so many filmmakers, photographers, and I've met many of them through, you know, through other jobs I've had, other media things, and you know, I met a photographer a few years ago, and he was still using film, and he said it's never going to die. Film is never going to be done, and I thought to myself, you know, that's great, but you got to understand that there's so much you can do with digital. And one thing I've always respected about you, Paul, is you've never balked at new technology. You've always been excited about it. And, you know, you came from era film and you've always looked at, you know, you're always about a year ahead of the rest of us. Even, you know, people that, you know, even people like me who I've resisted to change from DV tapes, and this is really geek talk to our listeners today, but you've always been the one to say, no, try this. This is the way it's going to be, and you've been right more than not. So you've survived in the business. You're still doing videos and films, and you're still working with students. And what are you doing with students now? Because we were talking about this a little bit last time we talked.
Well, we're more on the production end now, and that would be a natural evolution for anybody. I think once I had kids, and you guys used my kids in your movies, I think we had Maya the Human Sacrifice Child that was used in several sequences.
You are correct.
And we just allowed you to take our kids out to be in the movies, and then we came back and we went, wow, that's different. But we – since then – I mean, part of it is, you know, photojournalism and working with it's still a fascinating area of – there's a kind of an innocence and a wonderfulness about kids and about education that we're still on that – we're still involved in that in terms of – doing a lot of production for schools, for communities, and it's a never-ending well of great stuff. I mean, and you have to admit, kids are unbelievably interesting. As you know, when I had my own kids, I didn't have to do summer academy anymore. I got to be like the big parent for a while and a big leader for you guys. But after I had my own kids, it wasn't as important to me to do that anymore. And it was so I was able to like. You know, go move on to do stuff that was really interesting, more adult kinds of things, actually. Mm-hmm. And I think we're both doing stuff now that we're more interested in stuff that preserving things. I have a visual archaeology lab as part of our production company, and really what we're doing there is restoring media. We've been working recently on the Underwood and Underwood pictures, stereographic pictures from Egypt. And these were actually the television media of the 1850s. These had been around for a very long time, but nobody really knew what they are. You see them in antique stores. You see these goofy little two pictures side by side, slightly different, but you didn't know how to do them. We spent some time digitizing them and making them so that they were available as digital images now. And so, of course, you can still wear the glasses if you want to. Some of them are done that way, but some of them are also done just as Polaroid Polaroid filtered light, really, with kind of a window shade lighting. But and the thing is, you go back to 1905 to Egypt, you'll never see these things before. Underwood had done a lot of stereographic pictures, but they had never taken a picture themselves. They were simply publishers of them. And so one day they took the cameras out, and it totally was a whole new thing for them. In their 40s, they go to Egypt. They had the same things when we went to Egypt. We had the same issues. I mean, we had our handlers and our production people that helped us do things, but they had to be in our movies and our pictures too, because that's all we had, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can see this now when I look at the Underwood and Underwood pictures. I see them, the same guy showing up in all these weird ways, and I'm going, that guy was their Sherpa, basically. And they were saying, well, like, while you're here, would you mind riding on this donkey? And In fact, there was a famous donkey in the series too that shows up in various sites. One time we had the donkey, we had him reversed at first. We didn't quite know how to make it happen right. And so you can reverse a picture so that things you don't expect to stand out will stand out. So the donkey would be standing way out, you know, in the front, when in actuality it was supposed to be the other way around. The donkey was supposed to be in the background. But
and tell me, this is like you, like me, is there's always a fear that people aren't going to appreciate these things. And if we don't preserve them now, if we don't save them now, it's going to be forgotten. That's, you know, with me, whether it be people's, and I do a lot in commercial TV locally, because I think that people are too quick to throw away their tapes and their history. But also people have slides and photographs. And we've had the guy from Old Minneapolis on, you know, many times in the show here. And he's done a great job of preserving all these great photographs people have taken, which I think some people take a box of old photographs and they discard them, or slides, because they don't know how to play them or view them, or old films. And I really fear that we throw away so much history. I mean, we're a throwaway culture in as it is, whether, you know, whatever's old we throw away. But there's just so much history and so much we can learn about, you know, learn about ourselves, learn about where we're from and our community by looking at these old photographs. We're talking about Block E before the show started, and just look at that, how much that area has changed, but it stayed the same.
No kidding.
Just by watching that video and watching, and you were talking about watching, you know, Block E from the ramp, you know, from the ramp, you couldn't go into it. But you know, talk about history right there. You know, a dark history in our city, but let's not forget that. We did the sports stadiums. We've built them and torn them down three times in our lifetime. Let's take a quick break. I'll talk more about our guest today, Paul Augustin of iDream.tv. We'll be back here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB. Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond with my guest Paul Augustin of iDream.tv. Just a quick side note, Tom Arshu and I were talking that Old Minneapolis, this is a website or a Facebook page of old Minneapolis photographs. They have about 50,000 likes now.
Yeah, talk about nostalgia. When we first started, when we talked to Old Minneapolis.
Jesse, yes.
They had maybe 18, 19,000 people who liked their Facebook page. Currently, they're sitting at 53,881.
We take the credit for that here, right?
Absolutely.
Exactly.
30,000 more people just over the course of a number of months are just revisiting all this nostalgia and stuff that they truly remember.
Well, guess what? If you have a Facebook page, you can like KLBB
Woo-hoo!
Radio. You can
That's
also like
right.
TC Media Now, and I post a lot of video. We talk about on the Flashback Twin Cities show on the TC Media Now Facebook. We have about 1,000 likes on TC Media Now. It would be great to have about another 1,000. And you can go to tcmedianow.com. You can tweet at TC Media Now. I think that's a few ways you can get a hold of me. If you have some old tapes that you want to run by me or me to take a look at, you can go to tcmedianow.com, and I have a link to do that. I haven't pushed that in about 3 weeks. I felt I had to give a little push to that, Tom.
It has been a little while.
It has been a little while, so I need to do that every 5 minutes. Paul, we're talking about the way the film world's going, and we're talking a little bit about it's, you know, what you can do with just what you have in your phone. And a lot of us have iPhones. We pay a lot of money a month to have them, but there's just so much untapped ways we can be creative with them. And the industry is going to continue. Where do you think the industry is going?
Well, I think the traditional media has been just totally upended. I mean, you're going back and looking at how broadcast television worked. That just doesn't exist anymore. And people really do want to have media delivered to them, you know, on any device, anywhere, and, you know, subjects that they want to watch. So it's really video on demand is the thing. And so, yeah, Netflix is going to be really big. YouTube has just become a phenomenon to itself. I mean, it's like just this rolling monster. I mean, depending on who you listen to, it's somewhere between 46 hours and 100 hours per minute is uploaded to YouTube. Now, the scary thing about that is, are any of those videos worth watching? And then, you know, there's over 1,000 companies now that are taking a midday break, allowing people to watch funny videos at their desks. Actually, I made that up. That's not true.
There's companies that people are watching funny videos at their desks when they're supposed to be, working, unquote.
Well, that's been going on for a while. I mean, we've had our own people, you know, I mean, where we're...
That's research they do in your office, right?
Yeah, we think it is research, and we don't know exactly what they're up to. When they're searching goats, you really got to mm-hmm. wonder, what are we doing here? But I think, you know, also the quality of stuff. I mean, the iPhone now has, you know, 16 megapixels on some mm-hmm. of the cameras. You can record video and audio. One of the Academy Award winning films this year was Searching for Sugarman. The guy ran out of funds to produce it in film, so he ended up using an app on his phone, a Super 8 app of all things, and finishing his movie on a phone. And So really, the borders are down. You know, the idea of, you know, only broadcasting within your own little area, your own region. Everybody wants to have a website. They all want to stream it. In fact, it really doesn't work unless you are streaming it now. You just don't need the traditional thing. I mean, we still run a cable channel. We do all the production for it. It's cable channel 15 in Minneapolis. It's mm-hmm. a Minneapolis Public School channel. We do all the production for that channel, and we schedule all the programming that's on there. But it only works because we stream it, and people can get it anywhere. So we had to be on that. I mean, if you're not on the cutting edge of stuff, you're just not going to survive in the business. We brought streaming to them. We said, look, we can do this. We did our puppy cam video. We had a thing that we used a service that we were streaming video 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we brought to Tim and said, look, you got to stream these things because people want to look at it. We have never gone back the day after we did it one time, and it had to be done every single time since.
I think people are afraid to take risks, and I even myself included, because I think about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and you know, I had an iPod, and I thought, you know, this is great for me, but this is not going to catch on. Now, if I would have, you know, been a little bit more forward thinking, I would have taken more of, you know, my media and computerized it. I was still, you know, very much hard media, and I thought, I'm safe with hard media. I'm safe. Your DVDs, your tapes, your VCRs, and people are resistant to change those because, you know, now I think of how many times we've turned over. You know, the VCR was the big innovation, and then it was the DVD player, and now people are, you know, downloading from their TVs or smart TVs now, you know, smart refrigerators, smart ovens, everything's smart now. Smart lawnmowers, you know, cut without pushing it. But people are resistant to change what they don't know, and I think that for, you know, what I've learned in the last, you know, two decades, and think about TV and film production in the 50s to the 80s, not a lot changed. I mean, nothing, you know, the general, you know, film develop, a little bit of video, a little bit of Apex video, nothing changed. And from, I think, from, you know, mid-80s to now, we've turned over three different formats, I think, and there's still more to come. Is, you know, be a risk taker, don't be afraid to change. There's so much you know, convenience and so much creativity that can come from it, especially if you're into that kind of thing.
And I think people really did want to hold on to the actual. I mean, there are some things that you really want to own. I do download, you know, ebooks. Mm-hmm. And one day I downloaded, I mean, I have hundreds of ebooks actually, and I thought it was great. They're all on my iPad. I can get to wherever I am, I have all access to all mm-hmm. these books. And one day I just went, you know, I'm going to only read a few books. I might as well just, like, read the real book. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, you know, so I've kind of gone backwards. I'm going, like, paperbacks. You know, I had a guilty pleasure this summer of reading six hard-boiled crime books, one after the other. I mean, I read six books in 8 days. And I was just, like, devouring these books. But I love the fact that they were books. And so I think there's always going to be a desire to own the actual physical material, but I think a lot of stuff that we consume, maybe 80% of it, we don't really have to have it and store it and maintain it and catalog it and all that. You know,
well, how many of us have bought movies or books that matter? We watched one time and it's on the shelf and you wonder, well, why did I buy that? It was good to watch or good to read, but I didn't need to have the $30, you know, hardback edition.
Yeah, you don't go back, and we have a huge DVD library because we had the kids, so they have every video that they ever had, and I try to, like, move a few out. Are you kidding? I can't do it, and they still, like, have this reverency of these great stories, but they don't really go back and look at those anymore.
Well, it's and the bookstores will give you, well, I'll give you a quarter for them anyway. So they're, unfortunately, yeah. It's like VHS tapes now, and luckily I take those, but a lot of the commercial VHS tapes, which I don't want, by the way. You think about the plastic and the material that was, you know, put into these, and we paid $30 for them when the day they came out, and now they're going to be landfill.
We were totally fixated on that. We wanted to know how long would that tape last, and even back in the day, people were saying, you know, we'd go to 3M and we'd say, how long will this 3M tape last? And they'd go, well, it's going to last 100 years. And then they'd say, but there won't be any machines to play them. And isn't that the truth now? I mean, you're scrounging around for beta decks. I mean, we don't. There's just only a few decks out there.
It's amazing. The Betamax machines, we all joked and threw them out the window 20 years ago, and now I'm wishing I was catching them when they were throwing them out the windows in the backyard because those Betamax machines are tough to get by. I want to play a clip here. This is a TCMedianow.com clip, and this is a 39-year-old video that it actually turned 39 this week, and this is our man Dave Moore and Bud Kraling.
Do our weatherman return from the shores of Italy? How do you like your new home here?
I like the chair.
Comfortable?
Oh, yeah, the table and everything.
Orchestra's going to start pretty soon.
The dancing girls
yeah,
will come in.
Right.
You know, it reminds me of one of nature's proverbs, that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Now, we've got all these changes tonight, but I'm just back from Italy. That always seems to stay the same.
No matter where.
There you go. That's the words to live by for the day.
Those guys are great guys, too.
I mean, that is one of the new sets, Channel 4. This was the first night of they tried an hour-long newscast on Channel 4, and it didn't last very long because they couldn't compete with the Tonight Show. But, you know, Bud's back, and it's the same weather. It's a new set, but the more things change, the more they stay the same.
We had I had the privilege of working with both those guys, but Dave Moore one time, I had him read some scripts for me, and he came up to me and said, you know, this is the best script I've ever read. And I was so proud of that. I just went around and said, Dave Moore's read like how many thousands of scripts, and ours is the best he's ever read. Now, maybe he said that to everybody. I don't know. But...
Paul Augustin, thank you so much today. It's iDream.tv. Thank you so much for being here, and please come back again sometime soon.
Thank you. Thanks.
This is Tom Osmond. We'll be back next. Actually, we'll be off next Saturday, correct, Tom? We'll be
that
gone next Saturday. We'll be back in two Saturdays here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB Club 1220.